On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show, where we tell you the news as it happens and also tell you what the news actually means. That's our sort of specialty in life. Just a reminder for those of you listening, you can find us on YouTube, youtube.com/CliffCentralTV. You can get in touch with us on 0861-555-189 or follow us on Twitter at CliffCentral.com or Instagram or Facebook or WeChat. Just search Cliff Central and you're probably going to find what you are looking for. Now, on today's show, it's just myself, Simon Allison. I'm the Africa correspondent for the Daily Maverick, and I'm getting in touch with several of my colleagues throughout the hour. But what we have today is actually something of a theme, and that theme is around the subject of what news is newsworthy, what makes news newsworthy, and why are some stories so much more interesting than others. And if you just look at our front page, there's a few examples of this right now. An obvious one is the death of Robin Williams. The comedian died last night. He committed suicide, and we ran the story on our front page. And, you know, we've had a few comments from readers saying to us, well, who cares? He's just a dead comedian. People die all the time. Individuals die all the time. We don't cover every death of everyone everywhere. And, you know, it's a valid point. You know, why are some people more interesting than others? And the reason, I think, is it's fame and interest. And you got to remember that journalism is, of course, a business, and we have to give the people what they want, and the people want entertainment. And people like Robin Williams are always good value for money. Another interesting story that demonstrates this example is what's happening in Iraq at the moment. I'm not sure how much you've been following this, but an Islamist terrorist organization called the Islamic State has taken over vast swaths of Iraq and Syria. And we'll be talking to my colleague J. Brooks Spector shortly on this. He's written a story on the tragedy of the Yazidis. Now, the Yazidis are a sort of minority religion in northern Iraq, and they are almost under siege by these Islamic State militants. And it's quite an incredible thing. It harkens back to medieval times, this image of 40,000 persecuted minorities huddling on a mountain with no access to food and water while they're completely surrounded by armed men intent on killing them. You're thinking that in the 21st century we would be beyond that kind of thing. Alas, it seems we're not. Another story that we'll talk about in more depth later is the story of South Sudan and Somalia and the twin famines that both these countries are about to experience. We'll look at why they are going to experience these famines, but also, you know, it's one of those stories. If you look at the death toll that a famine is going to cause, the last famine in Somalia killed 260,000 people. That was 2.5% of the entire population. I mean, it's simply extraordinary. And the death tolls for these future famines will also be measured in the tens of thousands of people. And yet, what are the headlines? You know, if there is one public health issue in Africa that the headlines are concerned with at the moment, it is Ebola. Now, this is undoubtedly a nasty disease, but just in terms of how dangerous it is, it's only killed just over 1,000 people. So why are we so much more concerned with Ebola than we are with South Sudan and Somalia? Other stories on the front page include Greg Nicholson's take on Cyril Ramaphosa's testimony yesterday in the Marikana Commission. We will catch up with him today. He has been following Cyril's follow-up this morning. And also more on Joshua Broomberg, the schoolboy at St. David's, who, you know, he made the mistake of tagging himself in a photo on Facebook showing support for the Palestinian cause. And he has been quite viciously attacked by his community for doing so. Those are the main stories on the Daily Maverick today. I believe we have a caller ready. Is J. Brooks Spector on the line for us? Brooks, good morning.
Yeah, good afternoon there.
Good afternoon, absolutely. You're right. How are you doing, Brooks?
We've just gone to the magic hour of 1 o'clock, and we are afternoon. You want to talk about that story last night or this morning on the Yazidi? This is a group that I would bet that if you'd asked a million people at random, picked at random, who the Yazidi were, they'd look at you and they would be absolutely without comprehension. This is a tragedy that unfolded almost without the knowledge of anybody about whom was suffering. It turns out that it's a community of some 700,000 or so people, mostly, but not entirely, in northern Iraq, up in the hills, up toward the mountains, and they are ultimately ethnically of Kurdish stock, which is already a persecuted minority, and religiously, they operate in a closed society that draws wonderfully syncretic elements from Islam, early Christianity, Zoroastrianism, Mithraism, even ancient animist rites and ideas. The sun is a major god. There's a duality of good and evil. There is a messenger of God whose name sometimes is rendered as Shatan, or more colloquially, you might say Satan, and who has another name. God has seven divergent semi-deities that deal with the world, and on like this. And they believe in reincarnation, and they don't actually have a nether world to send bad people to. So all you can do is get better at it as you try harder in each successive reincarnation. In some ways, it seems like the ideal religion. It's borrowed neat things from everywhere. But as a result, they have been, on the whole, persecuted really since medieval times. Mainline Kurds, mainline Muslims don't like them because they are seen to be at best apostates and at worst heretics. And they don't get a whole lot of respect because of their Kurd origins. And as a result, they've been pillar to post for hundreds of years.
And Brooks, what's happening to them at the moment? What is the situation there? Why is everyone so worried about them?
Well, the news, it suddenly became clear that ISIS, that Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, as it is usually rendered in English, as it was intent on pushing its way through northern Iraq, the main opposition to them, in fact, was the independent Kurdish state, which was, in effect, also serving as a shield for the Yazidi. And once the Kurds were pushed back, then the Yazidi became basically fair game for the next set of marauders. And in turn, many of them, tens of thousands of them, fled up the sacred mountain Sinjar. But unfortunately, it's the middle of the summer, so the temperature is extraordinarily hot. There's no food, there's no water, there's no shelter. All there is desolation, and now increasingly the possibilities of painful and extended deaths. The British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, has been dropping small amounts of food, water, and sort of meals ready to eat, and some tent structures, and the U.S. Air Force is busy trying to beat back ISIS forces in northern Iraq. But in neither of these cases is it going to be sufficient to rescue them entirely from their travails or to keep them alive and whole and in some minimal amount of comfort as a community and as individuals. It's a deplorable situation, and it has this extraordinary human drama quality to it, which was what I think you were hinting at in your lead-in and intro, that something becomes newsworthy because it touches you somewhere on your spirit. This is a small community of people, basically don't hurt anybody, mm-hmm. and suddenly now they are front and center in the middle of a maelstrom.
It is quite an extraordinary story with those medieval overtones. Now, Brooks, let's chat quickly about the American mm-hmm. interventions. So they are bombing Islamic State positions and trying to protect the Kurdish areas in particular. I mean, you know, America left Iraq a few years ago, and now they're back. Is that what's happening? Can we expect a greater American military presence now?
Well, there's absolutely no public support for any sort of extended large-scale military engagement in Iraq or pretty much anywhere at this point. There are isolated voices in the Senate, people like Senator John McCain, who are calling for a major reintervention or re-engagement, right, is perhaps a better point. But at most, what you're going to see is a somewhat expanded air operation, which attempts to cut down the convoys and artillery emplacements and any rocket launchers that may come across, or supply depots for ISIS. But ISIS is not entirely a modern military machine. It depends a lot on road transport, but it doesn't yet have the kind of heavy equipment that is suitable for being knocked out by sustained air bombardments yet either. The problem is, will it be enough to protect the Kurdish autonomous region and, by inference, perhaps the Yazidi? Well, maybe. Will it be enough to roll back ISIS? Well, probably not. And that means that the warfare stays on the ground, stays bloody, and stays relatively indecisive. The central government in Iraq has shown very little capability in defending its territory. And in fact, the whole idea of a unified Iraq has become something of a fiction anyway. The Kurdish region, for all intents and purposes, treats itself as an independent country. The rest of the country is divided relatively evenly between Shia and Sunni Muslims, and the government, largely run by Shia Muslims, hasn't been, up to this point at least, in much of a mind to be an all-inclusive kind of institution, something that lots of people have been calling on them to do, and which seems to have had very little impact on their decisions.
Brooks, thanks very much for your time. I believe you have an appointment to get to.
Eye doctor.
Well, good luck with that.
Okay, I'll hesitate to say see you later. But
that was Brooks Spector with the latest on what's happening with the Yazidi community in Iraq. Now, the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has implications for not just that part of the world, but also for a lot of the issues that we're dealing with in Africa. Many of Africa's conflicts at the moment are driven by Islamist groups, and they will be very closely watching the tactics of the Islamic State, and perhaps looking to forge organizational alliances. Already, a story I reported on earlier this week was that Benghazi in Libya. Now, Benghazi was, of course, the crucible of the Libyan revolution. It was where the pro-democracy movement really began, and now it has been declared an Islamic State after it was taken over by an Islamist group. And it's quite an extraordinary turnabout in fortunes, and it happened shortly after Iraq's Islamic State organization sent back all of its Libyan fighters to Libya to help with the fight there. So the fact that this this ideology is spreading is something of great concern to us. Now we're going to go to my colleague Rebecca Davis, who joins us from Cape Town. Bex, are you with us?
How are you, Simon?
I'm excellent, Bex. I believe you're off to some ivory burning this afternoon.
I am. They are the Conservation Action Trust is staging mock ivory burn. So I don't know if there's going to be that much actual ivory being burnt in Globeberg this afternoon, which is a kind of symbolic act, but also recalling the large-scale burning of ivory that took place in Kenya a decade or a few ago. As a kind of mark of outrage about the ivory trade and its continuation. They have requested that members of the public who attend bring ivory trinkets to toss into the flames, but unfortunately, as a Daily Maverick employee, I find myself short of ivory these days, Simon. I don't know about you.
Well, clearly you're doing something wrong.
That's right. I think that's right.
Now, Bex, we're talking today on the theme of what makes things newsworthy and why some things are more newsworthy than others. And your story published today is a perfect example. You know, why has the Oscar trial really captured the imagination when other crimes that seem to be of equal severity have fallen under the radar? Will you just talk us through what you wrote today?
Certainly. So I was writing today, as I have on a few occasions in the past, because I think it's an important story to keep in the public eye to some degree, about the murder trial of South African artist Zweletu Mthethwa. Mthethwa, who I think it's fair to say is probably not a household name in South Africa, but is nonetheless an extremely celebrated South African artist and photographer. He's won international acclaim. He's had solo exhibitions at some of the most prestigious galleries in the world, New York, etc. There is a German art gallery, in fact, which has named an entire wing of its gallery after Zwelit, etc., which should be some indication of the esteem in which he is held in the public eye. So he really is a big deal in South African art circles and internationally, and he's achieved a great deal of success, as judged also by the fact that he allegedly drives a Porsche with a customized number plate, which for struggling artists is obviously, you know, a sign. So Zwelit Mthethwa is accused of the murder of a woman called Nokopila Khumalo, which took place in Woodstock in Cape Town in April last year. There seems to be a lot of exceptionally damning evidence against Zwelit Mthethwa, including the fact that CCTV cameras allegedly captured the attack with him on the attack. The fact that, as I said, he has a Porsche with a personalized number plate unfortunately makes it very difficult to get in that car and drive to commit a crime without being noticed. There's allegedly a tracking device in his car which shows that he drove to Woodstock, where the crime took place, at the time of the crime. And there are also allegedly eyewitnesses. So if we believe that that is the totality of evidence gathered by the prosecutors, it sounds like a very damning case. In fact, in some regards, it sounds like a much more damning case than, for instance, we see in other situations, like even the Shirin Diwani trial, for instance. So the dude seems to be in a lot of trouble, but the mysterious element is why there just has been this virtual media silence on this case. And to my mind, the more disturbing aspect is the evidence we have that Zwelit Mthethwa is not being ostracized by the art community, that he's not being sort of cast out. And this is evidenced in the fact that his galleries appear to still list him proudly as one of their major exhibitors, that they are clearly selling his work, that his agent is still representing him, and so forth. And as I said in my article today, it is worth considering how quickly Oscar Pistorius' sponsors hustled to drop him the minute that he was accused of murder. Now, obviously, there are some differences. For instance, Oscar Pistorius was representing various brands, which I think is a bit different to having your work sold or as an artist on a commercial forum, because it's not necessarily taken that you are supposed to be emblematic of the ideology of some particular product. But nonetheless, Oscar Pistorius is obviously a very inspirational figure. Even if you accept that he murdered Rivas Steenkamp, even in cold blood, there's no denying that what he did as an athlete was extremely impressive in terms of overcoming personal adversity. Nonetheless, people dropped him. They have absolutely scrambled to distance themselves from Oscar Pistorius. This really hasn't happened with Zwelit Mthethwa. And the question is why? So, I mean, one of the possible answers that I was considering was the fact that Zwelit Mthethwa is an artist. And for some reason, there is this kind of romantic idea that artists should be treated differently to the rest of us when it comes to this kind of crime, particularly a crime of passion, where it seems that artists sort of have more leeway morally because it's expected of them in a way, that artists are temperamental, they're wild, they're irrational, they're unpredictable, and that this kind of behavior in that sense sort of adds to their mystique, that it enhances public fascination with their persona. The more disturbing possibility is that the reason galleries and agents are sticking with Mthethwa is because this murder charge may actually enhance the value of his work. And I quoted in my article today two South African art specialists interviewed by The Times earlier this year who said exactly that there was every possibility that the murder charge would not damage his value, the value of the work, that it might actually increase it, and that if he were to get sent to prison, he might produce really, really interesting work, which would again sell for a high price. Which is just the most astonishingly crass and callous response to the death of a young woman, that it might in some way prove to be a spur to the production of lovely paintings. The irony of Zwelit Mthethwa as an artist is that he spent his life, seemingly professionally, in capturing the lives of disempowered black subjects and really imbuing them with a kind of dignity, meaning, and grace. For him then to have committed this murder of a woman who wasn't just a disempowered black woman, but also a sex worker. I mean, there's something so ironic about that, and also in the fact that we don't have a single picture of this woman, Nokufila Khumalo, available to us, apparently. This is one of the aspects tackled by a Sesha Simon documentary on her on Sunday, that it's very difficult to engage kind of public interest in outrage, rightly or wrongly, and it is obviously wrongly, when there isn't some sympathetic portrait of a victim. There's nothing. Okay. And when the victim is, frankly speaking, a sex worker. Because we still live in a society where, on some level, there is an assumption that if something bad happens to sex workers in the course of their work, it was coming to them because they're selling sex. It's a taboo. It's a taboo industry. They have no protection. It's a trade that is against the law, and as such, they deserve everything that's coming to them. Perhaps if his victim had been a beautiful young socialite like Reeva Steenkamp, we would be seeing a different story. And perhaps if his victim had been white, we would also be seeing a different story.
Well, Bex, I wanted to actually follow up with you on that issue, the racial issue. You know, in the Oscar Pistorius case, you've got a white murderer and a white murder victim, allegedly. Well, they're all white, no matter what the verdict is, I suppose. The South African media landscape is still quite dominated by white editors, white journalists, white professionals. Certainly, you know, most of the people who subscribe to DSTV with their 24-hour Oscar channel would be also fall into that category. What aspect of this is racial? Do you think that the Zweletu Mteto murder isn't so important because it's a black person who does it, and there is an association in this country between black people and crime?
I think that's entirely possible. I do think that's entirely possible, because I think that there is a sense that black victims are treated as run-of-the-mill in a way that white victims aren't. And we've seen this time and time again when white young women go missing or get kidnapped. The Lee Matthews case, for instance, over a decade ago. I mean, the country virtually came to a standstill in horror and outrage. This is literally a daily occurrence for many communities in South Africa who aren't white. So there is definitely that aspect of the victim. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that it is also the case that this black alleged perpetrator, a black accused, is also not attracting condemnation. So in a way, there seems to be a contradiction there, if you know what I mean. That perhaps, in a sense, he's getting an easier ride because he is black. It's a tough one, and it's also hard to know how much of this is due to less sinister motives and just because, realistically speaking, Zweletu Mteto is not as famous as Oscar Pistorius. It would be interesting to know, for instance, in a sports-mad country, how we would respond if the perpetrator was a Bafana Bafana player, for instance, or even a hip-hop artist, or just someone with a lot more kind of common cultural reach than somebody taken from this fairly elitist domain. But it certainly does raise troubling questions about whose lives the media values more. And I think there's definitely a troubling indication here that sex workers in particular are worthy of less sympathy and less attention.
Bex, thank you very much for your time. I do not want to keep you from your bonfire.
Thank you, sir.
Are you taking marshmallows?
Not. I feel that would probably be an inappropriate joke in the face of the gravity of the elephant poaching situation in Africa.
All right. That was Rebecca Davis talking about the strange disparity in coverage between some of the higher profile murders in this country. Now we are going to cross to the Marikana Commission, where our senior reporter, Greg Nicholson, is waiting to brief us on what Cyril Ramaphosa has said today. Greg, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Simon, and it's nice to be introduced as a senior reporter. I think that's a first.
Well, I think you've earned it after all these years. I think we were just celebrating our third year of working at the Daily Maverick.
That's right. And it's actually interesting now, being here, sort of, we've been working, you and I, at the Daily Maverick for 3 years, and for two of those years I've been sort of covering this Marikana Commission and Marikana drama. So it's quite interesting to see how long lasting this sort of thing is, and today we've had quite a bit of drama in the commission.
All right, tell us, what's been happening?
First of all, let me tell you the meaty stuff, the actual stuff of interest to finding the truth and justice. So, and then I'll get into the more theatrics of the day. So first of all, one of the key things is that we've got Dalia Mpofu, Advocate Dalia Mpofu, and one of the prominent EFF members, who's cross-examining our Deputy President, Cyril Ramaphosa. And Mpofu was quite clear that he's going to recommend that the Commission recommends that the MPA institute charges against Ramaphosa and some other people who have sort of been involved in sort of the causal links between sort of the politicians, the unions, lawnmen and the police that ended up in 34 mine workers dying on 16 August 2012 and 10 dying in the week before that. So what Mpofu is trying to prove today is it's sort of a few stages, but he sees Ramaphosa as the link between all these different people who sort of ended up then putting pressure on police to really crack down on these mine workers. And so what he's established, or he's been trying to establish, is one, that lawnmen did not want to engage with these striking workers when they went on strike in early August 2012. He's saying that, and sort of the documents from lawnmen show that they were worried of something happening similar to a strike at Impala in the previous months, where the rock drill operators went on strike and then got paid sort of quite a substantial increase. So they didn't want to engage, and they didn't want to be stuck in a situation where they would have to pay this sort of substantial increase. So then they sort of, you have to ask, and this is what Mpofu is trying to prove, is, okay, these guys are on strike and they're hurting our production, but we don't want to engage talks with them. Okay, how can we stop the strike? That's the idea where Mpofu comes, where Ramaphosa comes in, right? So then there's, from lawnmen executives and management, they put pressure and they contacted Ramaphosa and really told him about how bad this strike is and sort of how violent it is, how people are dying, losing their limbs to muti, all sorts of stuff like that, right? And so then they sort of pressured him and sort of tried to get him involved and see what he can do. Being Cyril Ramaphosa, he knows most of the decision makers in the country. So Ramaphosa then contacts Susan Shabangu, Minister of Mines, tries to convince her that this is a criminal issue. This isn't labour unrest, it's criminal. He contacts Ngati Mtetwa, then Minister of Police, and tells him the same thing. He also speaks to the National Union of Mine Workers, who weren't really involved in the strike, and sort of really tries to push this issue. And there's emails with him and talking to lawnmen, talking about how to get increased police presence and how to keep it there, so the strike can sort of end and work can resume. So Ramaphosa says that his key interest was safety, right? His key interest was trying to prevent more deaths. But the thing that the commission keeps coming back to today is then, okay, if he's trying to prevent more deaths, he's acknowledged, and the commission knows now, that the only way to sort of end this strike or to sort of prevent it from increasing in volatility is to engage these mine workers, to actually sit down and talk to them. But lawnmen refused. And so instead what happened is there's this increased pressure on the police to sort of really, really crack down on them and also characterize this thing as a criminal, sort of dastardly criminal act. And then Mpofu has linked that to this idea of shoot to kill and fight fire with fire. And so what Mpofu is trying to say is that lawnmen and Ramaphosa, you were using this language to convince ministers saying this is a dastardly criminal act. And the sort of inference from that is now it's time to shoot to kill. So that's where Mpofu is coming from, and he's really trying to hammer this point home. But being Dalia Mpofu, there's a lot of theatrics today.
I can imagine.
So some of the things, I'm not sure if you've seen on Twitter, but some of the things that we've seen today that have been quite interesting is Dalia Mpofu accusing Cyril Ramaphosa of engaging with all these parties and having a conflict of interest. Now, Cyril Ramaphosa, being quite the negotiator and debater, was explaining that, no, it's not a conflict of interest if you're... You know all these different people, and you're bringing them together for a common cause and a common good. And he said, like yesterday, Dali, you came up to me and said hello, and I asked you, do you have your silks yet? Are you a senior counsel in terms of the advocate, you know, law profession? And Dali told him no. And then according to Cyril Ramaphosa, Dali asked him, said he's still waiting for the president to sign the form. That's all that has to be done. Can you do something about it for me? So Ramaphosa brought this up, trying to sort of show that even Dali Mpofu, you know, abuses conflict of interest sometimes. And then it got quite heated with Dali calling him a liar, saying, oh, if you're lying about this, how can we trust your versions from 2 years ago? It got actually really heated.
It must be fascinating to be there in the courtroom, because these are both two men of towering intellect, and really slugging it out, and the stakes really couldn't be higher. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense, how does the courtroom feel? Is there a sense of tension and suspense?
Mm-hmm. Well, just to point out, first of all, it's not quite a courtroom. The Commission of Inquiry will make findings and then can recommend those to a court,
mm-hmm.
but does sort of act in a very sort of court-like manner. It is quite interesting to see these two guys slog it out, and all the other lawyers involved too. One of the problems is that while Ramaphosa sort of knows the stakes and he's really working hard to hold his version of events and paint himself in a positive light, Dalrymple often finds himself getting caught up in little arguments such as the one I mentioned, and he doesn't always pose questions in a manner that, you know, that could sort of be beneficial to gathering evidence. Sometimes he comes, you know, almost like having Julius Malema in the courtroom. He comes with these accusations and slander almost, and we get caught up in that a little bit. But it's really, really fascinating.
I mean, there is the political element to this as well. So Dalrymple is one of the leading members of the EFF.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Cyril, second in command at the ANC. You know, is this almost a proxy for their political fight going on at the commission right now?
Yeah, I think so. On different levels, actually. So I think the EFF-ANC battle is one part of this. And we've seen EFF members here at the commission. Yesterday I saw an EFF member who didn't have his EFF clothes on, but he was handing out T-shirts with a buffalo head on it, saying that I think says Mick Cyril, and he murdered people in Marikana or something. And they caused quite a commotion yesterday, and that was political. I think they came to agitate, and they've brought some sort of protesters who were singing outside. And that's so. I think the EFF is trying to use this to leverage support. On the other hand, I think the ANC knew that, and they said I was just sort of speaking quietly to an ANC member, and they said they expected worse. Actually, they expected a sort of more of a hoo-ha to be made. The other sort of politics involved, I think, is very much union politics. We still have a very, very sort of strong and ongoing battle between the National Union of Mine Workers and UMCU, And while neither of them have really sort of, like the EFF has, used this as a platform to sort of garner votes or sort of garner media attention and support, it does really play out in this forum, and I think it's quite important in the ongoing battle to see who's the biggest union in the mining industry.
Mm. No, absolutely. Greg, thank you for speaking to us today, and we're looking forward to your article tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
And you. If you haven't been following Greg's articles on the Marikana Commission, I urge you to do so, because he writes, he not only tells you what's you know, what the key players have said and how they've said it, but he really goes into some of the more dramatic elements and the tensions and the way that the players look at each other, and it really is fascinating stuff. Now, I did promise we would talk about South Sudan and Somalia. This is a story that I wrote yesterday and published this morning. It really is a messy part of the world, that. I was going to start with Somalia. I used to live in Somalia in a town called Hargeisa, which is part of the autonomous region of Somaliland. And so I know it quite well. And, you know, it's a bleak, barren country in many ways. It's not quite a desert, but it's certainly not fertile. The land, it's dry, it's hard. This really is a landscape that humans have struggled to tame, even in the best of times. If all things are going well, Somalia is still a hard place to live. But of course, things are not going well. At the moment, the country is divided into bits controlled by Al-Shabaab. They're an Islamist group, very extreme, that is looking to impose harsh Islamic law over the whole of the country. Other bits are run by these autonomous or semi-autonomous regions. You know, that there could be, you know, in Somaliland, it's a full-scale democratic government, and they're doing quite well. But other bits are little more than sort of tribal governments set up to try and just, you know, provide some very basic services. Then there are other bits still controlled by the actual government, which has very little power. What power it does have is pretty much maintained entirely by the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM. That's a coalition of troops from Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Burundi, and Sierra Leone. And they're really keeping this government in power, particularly in the capital and several strategic other towns. So this is the situation at the moment. You know, you really have a country that's just been divided by conflict and war and by 2 decades of it. They really have not enjoyed much prosperity in a very long time. And just to add to their woes, it has stopped raining. So a drought has hit, and what little food they can grow, they now can't grow. Of course, there being almost no governance whatsoever, there are no provisions, there's no sort of stores of supplies to tide you over through the bad times, because no one is able to implement foresight like that. So what we're looking at is a pretty severe famine. And to put this in context, the last time there was a famine in Somalia, it was 2011, only 3 years ago, it killed 260,000 people. That's 2.5% of the entire population. You know, it really, these are extraordinary numbers of deaths, all due to an entirely man-made phenomenon. Yes, drought is a natural phenomenon, but the only reason it's so severe is because the government has failed to look after its people. Then we move to South Sudan. Now, South Sudan is actually quite different. I've also been to South Sudan, and you fly over the country, and my word, it is lush. It is incredibly green. You know, I spoke to government officials there, and they said, this country will be the breadbasket of East Africa. We can grow enough in South Sudan to feed almost a quarter of the continent. You know, it's quite incredible stuff. And yet, they are also on the brink of a famine. And what's happened in South Sudan is about 7 months ago, the president and the deputy president fell out with each other and basically instigated a civil war. The civil war has taken on pretty nasty tribal overtones as well, and has left thousands of people dead, and more importantly, 1.5 million people have been displaced. Again, huge numbers of people affected by these kinds of conflicts. The problem is, this is a country that pretty much relies on subsistence farming. So people plant their own crops, they harvest their own crops, and that's what they use to feed themselves and their families. If you're not at home, you cannot plant your seeds. You cannot till your land. You cannot reap your harvest. And the way that the weather in South Sudan works is that the rainy season hits at about this time. And if you haven't planted your seeds by the time the rainy season hits, you really are in trouble, because you're not going to be able to plant your seeds then. And much of the country becomes pretty much impassable. There are no roads that link the major cities. Transport between them is purely by air. A lot of the airstrips are in terrible shape, so only helicopters can be used. Helicopters can't bring much in the way of supplies. So you have these huge isolated communities that really are unable to feed themselves. And again, what's needed in both South Sudan and Somalia is a huge international response. We're talking billions of dollars poured in, a lot of logistical support, a lot of technical support. However, the aid community is really divided at the moment between all kinds of competing interests. I mean, you've got Iraq, Mali, Libya, Syria, all these things happening, and poor South Sudan and Somalia just aren't going to get a look in at the moment. And again, it comes down to this thing of what is more important. How do you judge, A, what's newsworthy, and B, what needs, you know, to get the most of your limited resources? And I would argue that actually what's happening in South Sudan and Somalia is probably the most pressing issue facing the African continent at the moment, simply because of the sheer number of people that it is going to affect. Yet famine and drought, these are not sexy subjects. These are not subjects that garner much media attention, and they're not subjects which translate into much public pressure on governments to do something about it. And therefore, I don't think that the international community is going to be able to stave off disaster in either of these countries. Now, we are going to move to my other colleague, Ranjeni Moonsami, who... Ranjeni, are you with us? Hi, Ranjeni, are you with us?
Hello?
We're having a few technical issues at the moment. We can't seem to get hold of Ranjeni Moonsami.
Can you hear me,
back.
Simon?
Yes, hi, Ranjeni, you're
hi
back.
Hi there, Simon, how are you doing?
I'm very good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Now, you're not in Joburg at the moment. You're at home, I believe.
Yes, I'm in KwaZulu-Natal at the moment. I'm looking at the cows stroll past onto the field next door to my house. So it's quite a different scene from where you are.
That actually sounds delightful. I'm very jealous right now.
This morning I heard this weird sound waking me up, and I thought, oh my goodness, what is that? Is that like, you know, I mean, in the city, you hear trucks going past, you hear aeroplanes, you hear helicopters, and this was a rooster going for it, just outside my window.
You know, I often find people talk about the peace of the countryside, and I just don't get it. I find that whenever I'm in the bush or in somewhere quiet, it's either too quiet that I can't sleep, or there's all these unfamiliar noises like roosters and crickets and wildlife that keep me awake. I'll take traffic and sirens any day of the week.
Well, I tell you what, I'd rather have a rooster bleating next door to my window than a park town prawn. If there's anything that keeps me out, you know, it's that.
All right, well, Ranjini, you wrote a really interesting article. Was it yesterday? Yesterday was the one about women in South Africa, but last week you wrote a fascinating one on could South Africa be looking at a female president next? Do you want to just talk us through what you wrote?
Well, you know, this issue came about quite by the way, in May, just before the elections, where at the press conference, President Zuma was asked whether he thought South Africa would get a female president anytime soon. And surprisingly, or maybe he was just being politically correct, and he said, well, I think we'll get a female president sooner than you think. So, you know, that kind of stirred the debate a little bit. But the problem here is that the ANC Women's League, which should be the champions of such a project, if they should be one in the ANC, you know, they're rather reluctant to get into this debate. A couple of years ago, you had quite a senior member of the ANC Women's League saying, you know, we don't really have the caliber of people, you know, ready for such leadership positions in the ANC and in the country. And you had also the president of the ANC Women's League, Angie Motshekga, also being quite conservative in her thoughts around it. So recently we had the Minister of Social Development, Batabile Dlamini, saying, no, but the Women's League is having a conference in a couple of months and we should be pushing for it. That's what we should have. We should have a woman president. Now, last week when the president of Chile was visiting, the president said it again. He said, we could have a woman president sooner than we think. So I don't think that this is just a casual nice to have. I think that we're going to see a debate around this in the ANC as we approach the next national conference. And it's primarily because there isn't consensus in the ANC around the candidateship of Cyril Ramaphosa as the likely heir to the throne. Now, you must remember, Simon, how it came about that Cyril Ramaphosa came back to politics. He was drawn in by KwaZulu-Natal to partner Jacob Zuma at the Mangaung conference, so that, you know, together they were quite a formidable team, as opposed to the team put up by the forces of change who wanted Halima Motlanthe to be the next president. So the deal that KwaZulu-Natal made with Ramaphosa was that you come and support us now as the deputy president candidate, and we'll throw our weight behind you in 2017, when we have to elect a new president. So he came on that understanding. But what you're finding now is that even in KwaZulu-Natal, there isn't consensus around this. There's talk about the ANC Treasurer General, Dwelling Keys, who was the former premier of KwaZulu-Natal, about him being a likely candidate. And also the chairperson of the AU Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, but her possibly being a candidate. Now, Dlamini Zuma is by far the most, she's the most likely candidate for a woman president. The other names that have been mentioned have been like Naledi Pandor, Lindiwe Sisulu, who's royalty in the ANC. But I think Dlamini Zuma stands a pretty good chance. The problem is that who in the ANC is going to push the issue? Because the ANC Women's League seems to be reluctant, as I said. So the way things work in the ANC is that a person's can only proceed if you've got strong provinces or the leagues backing such a candidate. Now, the other problem for Cyril Ramaphosa is that because he's been out of active politics for so long, since around 1996 when he quit, he hasn't really maintained a constituency in the ANC. So he came back out of the blue. One, he maintained his position on the ANC National Executive Committee. He didn't really, keep in touch with his constituency in the ANC, and his primary constituency was, of course, the workers, because he came from the workers' movement as the General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers. Now, what's happening currently is that he's appearing before the Marikana Commission, and it's not going well for him. You know, Dali Mpofu and others are basically trying to show is that his interests were purely financial, and he was acting in the interest of the company on which board he sat, Lonmin, rather than acting in the interest of workers. And I think that apart from the distance that he has with his constituency at the moment, this could be extremely damaging for him. But the other factor, Simon, is that it's still a long way to go before the 2017 conference. So a lot can happen in that time. Ramaphosa can get in ground. Dlamini Zuma can be offered another position somewhere. So we never know. But I think at the moment, there is likely to be some momentum around this issue of a woman's president.
Now, let's talk, hypothetically speaking, of course, about, and of course, Zana Dlamini Zuma. She has been at the African Union for the last 2 or 3 years now. And by all accounts, she's doing a decent job there. The people I talked to at the AU say she is competent, she is organized and efficient, and she's getting things done. She is hamstrung by the nature of the organization in terms of, you know, ability to intervene, ability to comment on issues. And of course, she does come from the ANC background of strict organizational discipline. And I think we are seeing that. She has been unwilling to make any waves. Do you think that being out of the action, you know, being so far away from South Africa for the last few years, you know, it means she has been away from some of the bigger messes of Jacob Zuma's tenure. Is that going to help her, or is it going to hinder her that she's been so isolated?
I think it may help her. I mean, the past few years has been extremely damaging for the senior leadership of the ANC. And the ANC has been quite scandal-ridden, and Dlamini Zuma hasn't been in any way associated with it. And you must remember that she had quite successful 10 years both as a Minister of Foreign Affairs under Thabo Mbeki's presidency, and then later on as Home Affairs Minister, where she earned a lot of respect. And, you know, she didn't really get damaged by the battles in the ANC at the time between the Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma camp. And then when she went off to the AU, she's also didn't bear the brunt of other scandals like, that have damaged the Zuma government, such as in Kandla and the Vatkloof incident and, you know, a whole range of other things. And also, you must remember that the other issue that has plagued the Zuma administration has been overspending and abuse of funding for cars and houses and things. She hasn't got any of that on her. So I think, you know, things are looking quite good for her. The other thing that counts a lot in her favor, you would know, is that she has a lot of respect on the African continent. And that will bode well for her, both as Minister of Foreign Affairs and now as AU Commission Chair. She's got a presence. People respect her. People take her seriously. I think both on the continent and internationally in multilateral organizations, the people know her and they respect her. So, I think that she's the best bet yet. The only problem is that she's not here campaigning. She's kind of hanging back. So she's not really in contention at the moment. But the one thing that we shouldn't forget is that she was on the ANC list for the 2014 elections. She didn't decline nomination. So she can still come back. You know, after her tenure at the AU is complete, she can still come back and, start, entering into the race properly then.
Brilliant. Ranjani, thank you very much for chatting with us. We'll let you get back now to your cows.
Yes, they're really missing me.
No, thank you very much. That was Ranjini Munusamy, who's an associate editor at the Daily Maverick, talking about the possibility of a female president for South Africa in the near future. I'm quite intrigued by this idea of Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma taking over. One thing that does concern me is that she still is Jacob Zuma's ex-wife, and there's a danger of creating an almost dynastic political succession thing happening. You know, you think of these great political families like the Kennedys in America. The Zumas could be our equivalent, and I'm not sure that that is the best way for our democracy to go at the moment. Having said that, I think that's all our allotted time for this afternoon. We will be back next week at 1 p.m. You can find the Daily Maverick at www.dailymaverick.co.za, and please sign up to our morning newsletter, either on the Daily Maverick website, it's our first thing newsletter, or through the Cliff Central website. Sign up for the Cliff Central Daily Dose for all the news that happened while you were sleeping and the best analysis in the country. Till next week.